Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents They Were Here Before Us, a novella in pieces by Eric LaRocca, narrated by Kai Rubio. A word of warning. How do you do? Mr. LaRocca feels it would be a little unkind to present this book without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold They Were Here Before Us, a novella stitched together in pieces. Short stories, vignettes, novelettes, and meant to be consumed and considered as a thematically unified whole. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with two of the great mysteries of our earthy existence, nature and love. How does one inform the other? How does one encroach upon the other? How does one destroy the other? I think it will thrill you. It may enrage you. It might even nauseate you. So, if any of you feel you do not wish to subject your nerves to stories containing graphic depictions of dismemberment, disembowelment, interspecies necrophilia, heavily implied interspecies love affairs, or art as torture, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you. Doug Morano, Editor-in-Chief, Bad Hand Books. They Were Here Before Us. 1. All that remains is yours to keep. I can still so distinctly recall the moment when it first happened to me. The crucial, soul-defining moment when I realized that I loved her, and loved her in such a way that I understood I could never fully possess her as I had always intended. Perhaps love wasn't exactly the right word. In fact, perhaps love was far too benign of a word given the intensity of my feelings for her. After all, the word love usually implies that there are two consenting individuals, both capable of giving and receiving respect, admiration, esteem, tenderness. Though she might have once loved me, might have cared for me, nurtured me the way I had hoped, the way I had dreamed and wanted, that opportunity was now decidedly non-existent, considering the fact that she was dead, and had been dead for several weeks, when my parents first stumbled upon her corpse in a shallow ditch not far from a busy motorway. For my siblings and I, she was our first cradle, our bassinet, the very framework of our existence. All 30 of us were more than grateful for her body, as we had already begun to make our home, our refuge, our haven from the delicate intricacy of her cadaver. Her nostrils were our secret passageways where we could lose ourselves, where we could wander aimlessly until we were found. Her lips were our velvet cushions, luxurious pillows where we could sleep and dream until our next feeding. Her pride-open, ever-vigilant eyes, our relaxing sauna, far more preferable and far more tepid than any mountain spring. Her flesh, our holy communion, our sacred bond, the thing that kept us tethered as a family. We had gorged ourselves on her body's offerings day in and day out, our parents sometimes feeding us with bits of her they had taken and tucked away for safekeeping. For a family of beetles, we were keenly aware just how fortunate, how privileged we were to maintain such a luxurious environment. Our parents often regaled us with tales of former residences where they had to make do with the corpse of a shrew or the rotted body of a small possum. To find a human so healthy and in such excellent condition as she hadn't been dead for too long was a work of pure magic, an object of enchantment. Of course, as I look back on the moment when it first occurred to me that I loved her and loved her in earnest, I comprehended that those feelings, those sentiments, were present as long as I had been a living thing. A measly insect that crawls, creeps, and chews its way through the brawn of existence. After all, her body was all I had ever known. Still, as I looked back and recalled the moment I had first described these feelings as love, I realized I had always been innately curious as to how such a radiant, mesmerizing creature ended up flat on her back in a small ditch, hidden away in the darker corner of a lonely thicket. I couldn't help but wonder what had happened to her. I wondered why she always appeared frightened, her eyes and mouth permanently open as if forever caught in the moment of some terrible surprise. I wondered why parts of her silky auburn hair were now crusted black with bits of dried blood as dark as motor oil. I yearned to know her secrets. Perhaps the most beguiling and mystifying one had to do with the fact that her stomach was always distended. Our parents assured us that this was normal, and that all different types of bodies often decompose in such a way that causes them to bloat obscenely or inflate with gases. Regardless, I will always recall the moment when I was crawling my way across her belly, and I felt a distinct sense of affection, an indescribable feeling of joy, and how it seemed to overcome me almost instantly. It wasn't because I felt safe or because I knew my parents cared for their brood in such a way that meant we would never want for anything as long as we lived. Although those feelings were quite frequent and were well-founded given the love we were afforded, the thought that suddenly came crashing into my mind had nothing to do with that. It was a tremendous, remarkable moment. When I realized that I loved her, and loved her for far more than the mere use of her body as my home, my shelter. It wasn't long until I found myself scurrying across her face and weaving in between her nostrils, playing a game with myself that I knew she might appreciate if she were able to see me in all my glory. A curious part of me wondered if she might be disgusted with me, if she might despise me for all I had taken from her, or simply detest me for the fact that I was a mere bug, a small, pathetic insect undeserving of such beauty, such magnificence, such grace. After all, my parents had ravaged her and made a nest, a viable home in her body for their starving, insatiable young. To her, we might have been monsters. Perhaps we were. But she didn't object. How could she? After I realized the extent of my feelings, that I was deeply infatuated with this poor young woman who had been robbed of youth, beauty, and any semblance of proper human dignity, I found myself unsettled by the idea of using her corpse as my nourishment. The very thought of feeding on her, shitting on her, fucking on her, repulsed me unlike anything else. These feelings of revulsion, pity, and disgust compelled me to stop feeding regularly, and it was then that I began to starve myself in order to save her. It wasn't a noticeable change at first, but soon my brothers and sisters noticed I wasn't gorging like them at mealtime. I simply explained that I hadn't been hungry lately and that I wasn't feeling well. These excuses bought me some time, but not enough time to evade the suspicions of my parents who had noticed an unfavorable change in my appetite. Accusations were hurled at me. Words like ungrateful, immature, and spoiled. If only they knew how I truly felt, I thought to myself, luxuriating in the imaginary warmth of my one true love. If only they knew how I had found the very thing that matters more to me than life itself. When I was feeling particularly despondent and aching for a semblance of love or affection, I considered how I might refer to her, my immortal starlight, my everlasting beloved. After all, I couldn't keep calling her my beloved in my head, as I knew the thought would eventually slip out and my parents might hear. I wondered what I should name her. For some inexplicable reason, to me, she resembled the quiet, proper demureness of an Agatha. I decided that's what I would call her. I would refer to her only as Agatha. It felt silly at first, a mere insect deciding the name of a human being, a grown woman who presumably had a life filled with loved ones before she met her unfortunate and gruesome demise. Although it could be argued that she had more foes than friends, given the fact she had been reclining in the ditch for several weeks, and I'd not seen or heard any evidence of a search. "Are they looking for her?" I wondered. "Will somebody eventually come and take my beloved Agatha away from me?" I couldn't allow that to happen. I'd sooner die than see her ladled from this ditch to be buried properly inside a casket. After a few weeks passed, several of my brothers and sisters began to sprout wings and ferry themselves away from the home our parents had made for us. I lingered. I had no intention or plans of leaving. I think, on some level, my parents were acutely aware of that. Regardless, they were quick to ask me when I'd be parting from them, when I'd be brazen enough to leave the nest and find a home of my own, another corpse where I could roost with a beetle of the opposite sex and mate in order to complete the life cycle. To me, the notion of it sounded excruciating. I wanted nothing to do with other beetles, other members of my own kind. I only wanted to be with her, my true love, my darling Agatha. After weeks of coaxing me to depart, my parents gave up and flitted away to find a new nest. Whether they were exhausted with me or desperate to find newer, more comfortable accommodations, I was never fully certain. Despite my doubt, the moment I had been yearning for finally came. I was alone with my beloved Agatha. She belonged to me and me alone. Our time alone was short-lived, however, as others soon arrived. Various kinds of ants, worms, and maggots. Though I strained to explain to them how Agatha was a rarity, a precious gem that must be protected at all costs. The other insects and eaters of carrion would have none of it. They paid me little mind, scouring her body and gorging themselves on her as she continued to deteriorate, to rot, right before my eyes. I apologized to her day in and day out, assuring her that they would leave when they finally had their fill. Then something remarkable happened. Something truly incomprehensible and unexpected. I woke one morning and peered out from the corridor of her nostrils where I often slept, and it was then that I noticed something dark and wet lying in the dirt between where Agatha's open legs met. There, on the ground, was a dead newborn, its rubbery skin glistening as if freshly lacquered with oil. It was about as small as a baby rodent, curled up as if attempting to make itself smaller, as if willing itself to remain as precious and as delicate as possible in a world that so desperately wanted to harm it. I couldn't help but notice a blood-slimed rope attached to the newborn and coiling up beneath Agatha's dirt-caked skirt, as if the two were forever connected, as if nothing could ever tear mother and child apart. Not even death. Several of the ant colonies that had overtaken Agatha's body had already realized the arrival of the little corpse and were beginning to migrate from Agatha to the deceased little one lying further down inside the bowl of the trench. It wasn't long before the tiny thing's carcass was forever lost in a blur, a violent swarm of insects making their way across its soft pink skin. For several moments, I watched quietly as maggots burrowed between the child's eyelids, as worms slithered between its elastic-band lips. I did not feel pity or sadness or even disgust while watching the other insects crowd over the poor child's body and begin to devour, boring into the precious thing as if its skin were wet cotton. To me, the child deserved this. This was what I wanted. After all, I wanted to be alone with Agatha more than anything. That's what I wanted most of all. But a child? A child? That would ruin everything for me. Everything I had so meticulously planned, everything I had so desperately yearned for and hoped for. So, instead of begging the others to stop what they were doing as I had done with Agatha, I did no such thing as they swarmed the newborn. In fact, I encouraged them. I egged them on, cheered them on to eat as much as possible until they were fit to burst, until they were as disgustingly bloated as a tick on a newborn fawn. I shouted at them, contended that they wouldn't be fit to eat the imperial son of a sultan considering their lackluster performance so far. And they ate, and ate, and ate, and ate. Finally, after weeks, all that was left of the poor child was a dark stain, a trail of glinting viscera, a lost murmur of what had once been but was unquestionably no more. All that remained didn't even resemble the remnants of a human life. It was an abomination, a cruel, sadistic joke played by Mother Nature. After more weeks passed, and the weeks bled into months, the throng of hungry insects gathered on Agatha's body began to dissipate as they had finally had their fill. I kept watch, making certain they didn't take too much from her, making certain that what remained of her beauty and refinement was left untouched, undisturbed. It wasn't long before I was once again completely alone with my beloved Agatha, my sweet woman of many mysteries. I didn't chastise her for keeping such an enormous secret from me, nor did I condemn her for making me suffer by the sheer fact that so many others wanted her, needed her, but certainly not the same way I wanted and needed her. As I made my way toward her, crawling up her extremity knitted with rot, I found myself puzzled by her. It was somehow as if we were suddenly able to communicate with one another. She did not welcome me as I had anticipated she might. She did not rejoice at my arrival, did not welcome me with the reverence, the kindness, the tenderness I had imagined for so long, the intimacy I had expected when we were finally left alone. Instead, she simply lay there, without comment, without adoration, without anything. It was then I realized the truth. She hated me, despised me. She loathed me for what I had allowed to happen to her child. In some quiet part of her, she had expected me to protect her baby the way I had always strained to protect her. I knew this to be true. I didn't need her to say it. She despised me for my insect-like callousness, my uncaring attitude, my willingness to allow her precious child to be devoured right between her legs. Even worse, she was judging me. Her eyes, listless egg yolks secured in hollow sockets, fixed themselves upon me and glared at me with such unreserved contempt, such condemnation. "Please, Agatha," I begged her. "I wanted you to love only me." But she wouldn't listen. She received my pleas, my explanations, without comment. For the first time in my life, I felt betrayed. I felt shame for what I had done, the horrible thing I had let happen to that innocent, dead newborn. However, what hurt the most was her glaring, her unreserved staring as she silently condemned me in this life and the one to come. It was then that I decided I must do something that could not be undone, something that I had quietly dreaded while the other insects had their way with her, something I was keen to supervise every day to make certain they were healthy and in proper place. Her eyes. I realized that something must be done about the woman's hate-filled eyes. Without any further hesitation, I made my way to her left eye. I stared at it for a moment, quietly appraising what I should do and what would be the most painless way of putting her out of such misery. With a swift motion, I skirted beneath the flesh of her eyelid and began burrowing through the bulb of her eye. It burst like a sweet jelly in my mouth. I kept eating until her eye was completely gone and I curled inside its empty socket. Then, when I had finished gorging on her left eye, I crawled onto her right one and began feasting on that as well. Finally, two empty, sunken pits stared back at me. My work was completed. I had done the very thing I had promised I would never do again. Feed from my beloved Agatha. Now she could never judge me, could never loathe me the way I imagined she might. She would always love me, would always care for me while I coiled myself inside her skull and waited for the dawn to break, for the sky to split open with light. "You feel like home, Agatha," I whispered to her. Of course, she said nothing. What was there to say? Over the days, months, years, others might come. There might be scavengers, other animals that might tear her away and drag her back to the sanctity of their mountain dens. I always knew this, but they would never fully possess her the way I have. To them, she would be nothing more than a refuge, a meal, a transitory place to bury the larvae of their precious offspring. To me, she was so much more. Even better, they would never have her eyes the same way I had them. Even though they might dream, they might yearn, they might pine for a semblance of the same gift I had received, it will never be so for them the way it was for me. Her eyes will always belong to me. 2. Delicacies from a First Communion. I was never told the reason for his death. They never explained to me how or why it happened. Then again, why should they have? Of course, I was his companion, his confidant, his most trusted attendant, but that's certainly not how his estate viewed me. The various men dressed in expensive-looking suits traipsing in and out of his Floridian home the first few days after his demise regarded me with the same contempt, the same disdain a father might share for a deformed child. An egregious mistake. A loathsome abomination. They saw me as an animal. I was crude and obscene in every way one could imagine, and noticeably underdeveloped when compared with their supposedly grand intellect. "Chimps are usually quite smart," I heard one of them mutter as they passed the small enclosure where I had been sequestered since his body was discovered in the third floor parlor. "It almost looks as if he can understand us, doesn't it?"
"I'm surprised Edgar kept that beast in the house with him," the other one remarked, lordly sneering at me. "Disgusting. It looks as if it has a mind to chew our faces off."
Yes, perhaps they were right. Perhaps I had considered leaping out of my enclosure, attaching myself to their faces and clawing until I could peel the skin from them in thick, bloody threads. But I knew for certain that was what they expected of me. I had never been one to surrender to people's expectations. That was what made living with Edgar so grand, so wonderfully divine. He never expected anything from me. Even though our means to communicate were limited considering the fact I was what I was, I knew for a fact he never subscribed to the notion that he held a station above me. He made it certain that we were equals and always would be. However, his lover, Sai, did not feel similarly. Even though Edgar had adopted me long before he ever met the tan-skinned, dimple-faced socialite from the Hamptons, Sai made every effort to let me know that I was an unwelcome guest in the house. When Sai stayed over, I was not allowed to sleep in the master bedroom, as was usually my custom when Edgar and I had the house to ourselves. When Sai stayed over, I was always segregated to a small crate near the house's basement-level laundry room. There I would usually have a small blanket and some rations that Sai would prepare for me. I often wondered if Edgar knew just how poorly his lover treated me. There were, of course, times when I wish I had the capacity to ask him. Moreover, there were times when I wondered if Sai knew of the connection Edgar and I shared together, the love that tethered us and that could not be broken even by the arrival of death. However, now that Edgar was gone, I couldn't help but wonder what might become of me. Naturally, I expected the executors of his estate would parcel everything away until all his earthly possessions were scattered to the winds. As much as I detested to acknowledge the fact, I was considered one of the dead man's mere possessions, relics from a departed era to be discarded, to be scattered as if I were nothing more than a useless artifact from a forgotten civilization. Perhaps that's what I was. Perhaps I possessed the same usefulness of a dead language. After all, that was what Sai thought of me. But I had to do whatever I could to prove him wrong.
"What's to be done with the chimp?"
one of the men asked Sai as they passed by my enclosure again. I straightened a little while I sunned myself underneath the glow of the afternoon Pensacola sun.
"What's the damn thing named?"
another one asked. Edgar always called him something.
"Enkidu,"
Sai muttered. I perked up, my ears pinning at the sound of my name. "Named after one of Gilgamesh's companions," he said. One of the gentlemen dressed in expensive black circled the small outdoor enclosure where I was secluded. I waited until he was about a foot or so from the railing that separated the concourse from the enclosure, and then I lifted my ass into the air and defecated right in front of him. Out of my peripheral vision, I noticed some of the other gentlemen glancing away in visible distress, violently fanning the air as if to cure some of the horrible smell of chimpanzee shit. Sai seemed to receive the spectacle without comment, without objection. After all, he was accustomed to my disobedience.
"You're seriously considering keeping this creature?"
one of the men asked Sai.
"A zoo might be far more preferable."
"I don't have much of a choice," Sai explained, his eyes lowering and his voice quivering a little. "Edgar made me promise that I would take care of Enkidu if anything terrible ever happened." One of the gentlemen smirked at Sai.
"How terrible can it be? You're a richer man now because of Edgar."
"As long as Enkidu is alive," Sai said, eyeballing me with an icy glare as if knowing full well that the two of us were tethered now just as Edgar and I were once joined. Sai hated me, loathed me, despised me, that much was certain. However, I couldn't help but dread the moment when he would inevitably discover the truth about his beloved Edgar and me, the reality that there was something more between us, something that no one could ever possibly begin to understand. After the gentlemen with leather briefcases and expensive-looking jewelry abandoned the house, the moment I had been dreading finally arrived, I was left alone with Sai. I knew there was every possibility that he would ignore me, that he would continue to keep me locked away in the gated outdoor enclosure even on such an unusually humid summer evening. But then something remarkable happened. Sai appeared as if out of thin air, lurking beneath the vine-draped portico arranged beside the house's veranda. He stood there for a moment, gazing at me with such visible hatred, such unreserved animosity. As he idled there, I couldn't help but notice how he held a small notebook in his hands. I squinted and recognized the notebook as the same one Edgar would always write in late at night while we lounged in bed together. Slowly, Sai approached my enclosure.
"You monster,"
he hissed at me, his brow furrowing and the corners of his lips curling.
"If I could, I'd rip you limb from limb until you were confetti."
I straightened a little from my slumber, bleary-eyed at first. As Sai approached the locked gate, I could see his lips practically frothing with rage. He resembled one of the silverback gorillas I had seen at the zoo when I was much younger.
"How could you?" he asked.
But before I could make a movement, before I could do anything, Sai retreated to the house and disappeared through the double-paned glass doors, slamming them shut and nearly shattering them. It was then that I knew. Sai had discovered the love Edgar and I shared when he wasn't present. Somehow, Sai had uncovered the truth. Perhaps Edgar had written about our romantic activities in his notebook. Perhaps Edgar had summarized in detail the physicality of our romance, the ways in which our bodies were joined in unbridled passion. I couldn't be certain how Sai had discovered the reality of our love, but...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?